Bat Segundo here, and I'm pleased to report that Miss Snark's attorneys have been flexible to something called non-binding arbitration. I think I'm going to win, but of course, we shall see. Anyway, we have a lot of housekeeping to take care of before we give the floor to our young roving correspondent's interview. First off, two shows ago, we asked our listeners the following question.
If you were a fish, what type of fish would you be and why?
Well, we were quite astonished at the email that we received. Apparently, some of you have been really thinking very carefully about aquamarine life vicariously. I'm a little worried. I was quite afraid by some of your responses, and I can only imagine what your social calendars looked like. Anyway, I don't want to go ahead and bear any grudges here, but here are some of the responses we received. Justin Coker wrote, I would be a large mouth bass because he is the king of the freshwater lakes. He is a fierce predator that devours other fish in a single gulp. If there were a comparable fish in the sea, sharks and killer whales wouldn't have a prayer. And if the largemouth could sing, he would probably be an excellent baritone. Well, too bad, Justin. I'd never really known a fish to sing, and besides, we're a little too quick on the draw, but maybe next time. A gentleman named David wrote in, if I were a fish, I would be my great uncle fish, his real name. His hands were ruined in a house fire while trying to save his sleeping children. That side of my family seems to have been plagued by house fires. He kept hundreds of softballs in the trunk of his pea-green Pontiac, and he liked very few people. Or was it that very few people liked him? I can't keep my family history straight. Well, I was quite confused at the juxtaposition of fire and water, and that's all very sentimental, and I'm sure it actually strikes a certain kind of personal chord. It did certainly make Jorge cry, but I'm so sorry, David, you didn't win. Dan Wickett wrote, if I were a fish, I would be a fish similar to the incredible Mr. Limpet, because A, I wear glasses, and B, believe it would be an awesome feeling to trick a torpedo into missing its intended target. Well, Dan, you do have the Don Knotts recent death thing working for you, but you were email number 3. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, Mr. Wickett. Your enthusiasm must be rejected. The winner, actually, of this philosophical contest is John Barlow, who wrote, I would be a John Dory because it sounds not like a fishy name, but a human one. So I can join those mail order book clubs, get the big dictionaries and encyclopedias, then not pay because I'm only a fish. Well, congratulations, John Barlow, and that's one hell of a scam, if I do say so myself. So, Mr. Barlow, you are the winner of Eat the Document. We will be sending it to you this week. Now, here were some of the other answers. Jonathan Shipley wrote, I'd be a crappy. That's a funny word, crappy, ha-ha, crap, giggle, giggle. Well, ha-ha, indeed, there was no amusement here in the Bat Segundo studios. Are you a writer for Howard Stern, Mr. Shipley? I think I've soiled my boxes with your lacking scatological wit. Please do try harder. Tito Perez wrote, could I be a fish? I would be go for anchovy because it seems to be both wildly loved and reviled. Well, we appreciate your enthusiasm for the underdog, Mr. Perez, but it's certainly not enough to win. You were a little slow on the draw. So anyway, congratulations, Mr. Barlow. Anyway, we'll go ahead and get straight to the point. This week's guest is Erica Zhang. She is the writer of numerous books and devised a form of copulation in which the zipper wasn't really necessary. Anyway, I'll let our young roving correspondent deliver the goods and introduce her. If you got a good day, here's a little tip that I would like to relate with my pole and my light. I'm going fishing, the mama going fishing, and the baby going fishing too. I am here with Erica Zhang, author of Seducing the Demon, also Sappho's Leap, and then there's some book you wrote, I think, about the phobia of flying. I didn't hear about this one.
Fear of flying.
Yeah, I know. How are you doing, Erica?
Oh, I'm great. Okay. I'm having such a warm reaction to Seducing the Demon. It's really a joy to go out and meet the people who read my books.
Sure.
It's been a great experience.
Okay. Now, I wanted to first of all ask, before we get into Seducing the Demon, your writing is both sort of confessional and conversational, where the two are sort of almost inextricably linked.
And maybe we can talk about this because we are talking about a book that deals with the memoir of writing. But even in like Sappho's Leap, you know, it still has a kind of very conversational, confessional tone with relation to Greek mythology. I was wondering if you might be able to comment upon how the confessional and the conversational sort of, you know, play into your work.
Well, you know, I always say when I teach writing that the most important thing to find is a voice, mm-hmm. a voice that really gets your own voice. And most writers, including me, have a tough time finding that. I mean, I spent much of my 20s imitating Nabokov because I loved Nabokov so much. And there are certain mentors you shouldn't imitate too much because they're so individualistic that only they can do it. So it took me a while to find the voice that was my voice, and I found it first in poetry. Accessible, conversational, sometimes a little slangy, the way people talk, the way my contemporaries talk. And once I found that voice, I was able to say certain things in it that I wouldn't have been able to say without the voice. But I think that's every writer's journey, is to find that, to find the voice that's theirs. What amazed me about my daughter, Molly Jong Fast, is that she found it at 19. In her first book, Normal Girl. And that's very early. Most of the writers that I've taught, you know, go searching for it for a decade or more.
Sure.
Before they find a voice that's really theirs.
Well, I mean, going back to this issue of poetry, I mean, it plays also a big part in this memoir. You constantly recite it. You constantly sort of let us know that, yes, you started off as a poet, but has it bothered you in the wake of the success of Fear of Flying and your other books, the Isadora Wing books? Has it bothered you in any way that you are more associated for Isadora Wing than for your poetry? Or?
I think the poets disowned me when I became a successful novelist, although it's not that unusual for poets also to write novels. I mean, many poets have started writing novels just to make a living because you can't make a nickel writing a poem.
Sure.
So, but I was particularly penalized, even though I went on writing poetry. And I'm collecting poems for a new book, which I hope to publish in the next 2 years or so. But it was strange. When I published Fruits and Vegetables and Half Lives, I was winning all the prizes that young poets had won, like a prize from Poetry Chicago that was won by W.S. Merwin and Sylvia Plath. And yet, after I published Fear of Flying, nobody would review my poems.
Wait, 1 second.
Okay, no problem. Well, anyway, going back to this issue of poetry and how you were identifying here, how the poetry world sort of turned their backs upon you after you wrote Fear of Flying. Maybe you can sort of elaborate on this.
Well, you know, poetry is very important to me. It's not only where I started, but it's the way I get into every new book. Usually, poetry tells me what are the preoccupations that are going on in my subterranean mental world. And so almost every novel has started with a sequence of poems. I mean, in Sappho, I include the sequence of poems at the end that led me to the book.
Yeah.
But it opens the door for me into the unconscious, I guess. And I think maybe my poetry is what will be most remembered about what I do. It may well be. I mean, my poems tend to be widely anthologized. People pick them for anthologies, certain particular ones more than others. And yet, I'm sort of cast out of the poetry scene. Poetry scene is very much a jar of tapeworms feeding on each other. That's Hemingway's phrase for the New York literary world. But poets are so hungry for recognition, and in America they get so little.
Yeah.
It's not like Russia or South America, you know, where somebody like Pablo Neruda is made an ambassador and travels all over the world. And American poets are so needy and hungry, and they feel so unloved.
Well, also,
so they don't really like it if one of their kind gets attention.
In Neruda's case, too, the people know him, too. I mean, he's like a champion of the people. And so it's a very sort of interesting case. I mean, what we have is we need, like, you know, some crazy sort of heir to bail out. So Poetry Magazine, which is what we had like a couple of years ago. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on how poetry can kind of restore its place in American culture? Well, or is it doing just fine with the slams?
It's not really doing fine. I mean, because I think so many literary critics have stressed the difficult, inscrutable poetry that many, you know, normal people who are readers don't read it because they think it would be too hard for them. I know that many, many years ago when we were both starting out, we had the same editor, Steve King, who really loves poetry and enjoys it, said, you know, the critics have ruined poetry in our country. Mm-hmm. And I said, why? And he said, because the poetry they celebrate is so inscrutable, is so hard to understand that people think poetry is hard. Mm-hmm. And if they celebrated poetry that was more accessible and understandable, people wouldn't turn their backs on it. Mm-hmm. I notice that when somebody dies, or a baby is born, or a couple gets married, people turn to poetry. Mm-hmm. For rituals in life, you know, they turn to, you know, to find a poem for a wedding ceremony, to find a poem for the death of a parent. Mm-hmm. So poetry still has a very sacred function in our world, but it's been pushed to the sidelines, mm-hmm. which I find sad.
Yeah. You know? As is fiction to some degree, particularly literary fiction. Well, that's another topic. But anyway, I want to go ahead and get us to the book before that you're here for. I wanted to ask, first of all, about the Andy Sturt affair, for going from the literary to the tawdry, I suppose. But I'm wondering why you, you know, you came here, I know, to the Commonwealth Club in 2003, and you didn't mention anything about this, and I know the subject of Martha Sturt came up.
Did it? I don't remember.
Oh, no. It was interesting that there was a lot of talk about Martha Sturt and what her role was in relationship to sort of American society, but the Andy Sturt thing didn't come up, and I'm wondering why you brought it up now, and why after 20 years, and why not just...
26.
26 years, rather.
27, maybe. I'll tell you, it was not an affair, really.
Or a fling, rather, to be more specific.
But I would say I started writing tales in this book about really stupid things I had done in my literary life. Mm-hmm. You know, allowing this old lizardly publisher to seduce me. Things that would happen to somebody who was very young and suddenly cast into the literary world and was really vulnerable and didn't know what the hell she was doing and made a lot of mistakes. Mm-hmm. And actually that story comes up in a chapter about mistakes in my life. So I fully recognize it as one of the stupidest and most imprudent things I ever did. I certainly would apologize to Martha if she were here today. It was really dumb.
Yeah.
But you know, Tom Stoppard says, hotel rooms inhabit a separate moral universe. Musicians say what goes on the road stays on the road.
Yeah.
People who are exhausted at a huge book fair, very insecure, tired, sometimes do really dumb things and that follow them for years. And basically, this isn't a chapter about idiotic things I did in my life, which later perhaps fed into my writing or fed into my understanding of myself. Mm-hmm. So I'm hardly glorying in it. I mean, I'm really apologizing in that chapter. And so, I mean, that's why it's there. It's a kind of mea culpa. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I was right. I was totally wrong in doing that. But it would have all been forgotten except that Martha has carried it on for 27 years.
Yeah.
She's told tabloid journalists that I ruined her life. She's all the trashy biographers who wrote about her, like Chris Byron and Jerry Oppenheimer and people like that. She said, that woman ruined my life. She's carried it on so that when I was writing this memoir, my publisher kept saying to me, what are these rumors about you having ruined your classmate's life? How well did you know each other at Barnard? Did you like each other? Whatever. And I began to tell the story, and I thought it was rueful and funny. Mm-hmm. And my mantra is never cut funny. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's there. And I up until the last moment, I thought, oh, I shouldn't publish this.
Yeah.
But there is something about the story that evokes a young writer, mm-hmm. and the kind of mistakes we make when we're young. So there it is.
Okay.
Better or worse.
Well, I was kind of curious because, I mean, like, for example, the publisher's story you were just mentioned is just really, really terrible. Funny, but terrible at the same time.
Terrible.
I mean, you know, it just seemed to me that this, you know, I just was wondering why not just take the high road and not respond to something like this.
Well, I hadn't for about 26 years. Yeah. But I'll tell you something else. My generation of women sort of didn't know how to deal with public life. Mm-hmm. We're trying to help the next generation deal with it. We never quite knew, because we were good girls of the 50s, essentially.
Yeah.
When some publisher came on to us, we were never quite sure, should we or shouldn't we? What was the politic thing to do? We were made into sex objects. Mm-hmm. We were not seen as creators or artists. And, you know, one was always in a quandary. You know, should you run around the table and get away from the guy? Mm-hmm. Or should you say, oh, fuck it, you know, maybe this will be good for my career? Never in these two cases, the cases were so, they were both bad for my career.
Yeah.
And they both hurt me. But it was my generation's struggle to understand, what do we do? Do we behave the way men want us to? Or do we walk away and say, this is business, you know, stuff it, bud, you know, put it back in your pants. And maybe I will write more about that in the future, about the generation of women who grew up in the 50s, you know, studying to be Doris Day, mm-hmm. came of age in the era of Gloria Steinem, and then saw the whole thing go backwards, mm-hmm. with the generation of Princess Di, who was lauded for her virginity, of all things, after we had sort of said bye-bye to virginity. We grew up in a very confusing time, and we didn't know what the rules were. Mm-hmm. And perhaps I should have gone on more about that. How does one create a new etiquette for the liberated woman?
Well, at the same time, though, since the Isadora Wing character is so close to you in terms of details, it would almost kind of maybe feed in to that kind of, you know, persona or pseudo-persona, and might actually help you as a writer for those who are following the Isadora Wing character. Well, maybe, mm-hmm. Would it not?
I don't know. It's all a mystery to me, mm-hmm. what works and what doesn't. I am always surprised by what the media latches onto. Mm-hmm. I'm very surprised by it. You know, I'm essentially a defrocked academic. I was on my way to getting a PhD in English, and to see what the media seizes on and makes much of is always a shock to me, you know?
Yeah. No, it's a shock to me, too, what they dwell on. The Dan Brown suit, for example, it's just endless. I mean, it's just, you know, I lost interest in it completely, but all these pages
in
are being
England,
in the plagiarism suit, yeah.
I haven't read that other book, the book that talks about Opus Dei and the influence of Opus Dei. Hmm. It's interesting, though. I mean, I read the book. I thought it was a very quick read, well plotted, a page turner, but completely silly and hokey.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can see, you know, I lay down on my bed one afternoon and finished it by 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I don't believe for a moment that there are these evil Opus Dei members going around manipulating or stabbing each other in the Louvre or whatever. I've heard better rumors about the Vatican than that.
Yeah.
I mean, and they aren't even rumors. Things about the banks and the laundering of money and so on. I mean, there are things to write novels about
yeah.
concerning the Vatican that could be fascinating. You don't have to make it up.
Well, you know, at the same time, though, you kind of have to, I think what he's maybe taking advantage of in this book is the sort of puritanical American impulse, which remains sort of tried and true about, like, how we're willing to sort of, like, be titillated to some degree by some of this stuff, but only to a certain sort of point.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, I'm sure, I mean, you obviously face this in your career, too.
Constantly.
You know.
Constantly.
I mean, being known, for example, for, the zipless fuck, or having right. that possibly written as an epitaph or something. I mean, you know.
It will be on my tombstone.
Yeah, exactly. But when, in fact, the fear of flying is a lot more than that, you know? I mean, it's an examination of one woman's neuroses about what she can sort of do with men. I mean, you know, it's what she can do for herself. I mean, the zipless fuck is only just one kind of component of that. I mean, why do you think people sort of want to concentrate on just the zipless fuck component when there's the entire sort of novel here of things to think about? And they also the sort of, you know, the confessional tone, that what we were talking about earlier.
Right. It's true. I mean, it definitely is true. I think it's interesting, though. I think a lot of people never read past the zipless fuck.
Yeah.
Quite honestly. And that was in the very beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And they seem to have overlooked, and also people don't read carefully. So they take out of the book what they need. There's a famous quote that I love. A book is like a mirror. If an ass peers into it, you can't expect an angel to look out.
Mm-hmm.
So people bring to books what they think already.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if somebody reads Fear of Flying and they're obsessed with pure, you know, they're puritanical, and yet they're really turned on by sex, and they're in conflict, and there's ambivalence between their desires and what they feel comfortable acting out. They'll bring all of that to the book, and they'll see things in the book that aren't there. What always surprised me was that much of the sex in Fear of Flying took place in the land of fantasy.
Yeah, yeah.
And people thought it was an exhortation to go out and do it.
Yeah.
And that amazed me, because it seemed perfectly clear to me in the book that these things were Isadora's fantasies. She didn't act them out most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and I think it, and I think the book kind of liberated women to say they had fantasies and to realize that they weren't perverts if they had fantasies. Some people took it as an exhortation and said, okay, I'll do it. But not everybody.
Yeah.
Some people understood that it was really about fantasy.
Yeah. Or the notion that women do, in fact, have these sexual desires, you know, or
right.
they do actually have a sexual imagination, which, exactly. you know, which actually, you know, it seems strange to think about this as a kind of revolutionary concept in fiction, but back then, you know, things were only just starting with, like, you know, the second wave of feminism and things like that. You touch upon in this book, you mentioned chick lit, and mm-hmm. I wanted to kind of see if we can talk about this, about the comparison of the environment that you wrote Fear of Flying, where you received reviews from John Updike and Henry mm-hmm. Miller, I mean, very favorable reviews. Whereas now, if you write a book, it's called chick lit. It's not just a piece of fiction. And even, like, you know, Curtis Sittenfeld in the New York Times Book Review wrote this sort of, you know, really scathing indictment of any kind of fiction that deals with women's issues as, quote, chick lit.
I know.
I mean,
I'm troubled by that, and I agree with Sittenfeld. I mean, I think that women of my daughter's generation are being ghettoized in the chick lit ghetto. And, you know, Molly wrote Normal Girl when she was 19. It was published when she was 21. She's written another wonderful book, which was originally published as The Sex Doctors in the Basement, but has come out in paperback as Abnormal Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Very funny. Her publisher is Random House Vintage. And she is a wonderful writer, but I see her and her friends put in this ghetto of chick lit and not seriously reviewed,
mm-hmm.
or reviewed by other women who are jealous of them and want to put them down. I think it's much, much worse than it was then. I mean, I got a tremendous lot of criticism all over the world for Fear of Flying, but from time to time, you know, vicious criticism, but from time to time there was an Updike or or a Henry Miller who would say, hey, this is something new. Let's look at this. This is something that women are doing for the first time, and this is going to change the way women write books and the way men write books. So from time to time, I would get a really serious appraisal where people would see it as a phenomenon, as a literary and cultural phenomenon. Usually the people who did that were really wonderful writers themselves, mm-hmm. who had the generosity to embrace. I mean, good writers are generally more generous than the literary critics. Anyway, that was really good. I don't see that happening with Chick Lit. I see women in their 20s and 30s being put in this ghetto and dismissed. Mm-hmm. The publishers commercially want to sell it. They put the pink covers on.
Yeah.
They're all books about a girl searching for Mr. Right, going through many Mr. Wrongs, going through many Mr. Right Nows, and it ends, hopefully, with a wedding. But that is, you know, that's a cliche of women's writing. How can I find the right guy? And the story ends when she finds the right guy. And what are we going to do with women's lives beyond finding the right guy? It's like saying, you know, getting married, having a big wedding is it for women. Mm-hmm. That's a very retro concept, isn't it?
But at the same time, in this book, you talk about your own sort of successful marriage. And I don't necessarily believe that marriage as an institution is necessarily enslaved. It doesn't have to be if both parties kind of work at it.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, and not only that, but also, when we're describing the ghetto of Chick Lit, I mean, you know, I don't know if it's fair to sort of put Jennifer Weiner, for example, into sort of a Chick Lit category, because she has very, very good observations about mm-hmm. women and behavior, even though there might be a sort of template here of, you know, yes, a woman getting married at the end. But at the same time, you know, a woman looking for Mr. Right, well, simultaneously, one might argue that Isadora Wing is, in a sense, kind of looking for Mr. Right,
too. She certainly is. She certainly is. I think, you know, I think we all want to be loved, and we all want to be known by somebody, and we all want to have a soulmate, a partner. There are people who are very, very isolated, who seem incapable of doing that. And I've known many of them, some straight, some gay, who say, I want a partner, and yet whenever anybody comes close, they push the potential partner away. I've seen it again and again in certain friends. But most of us do want a partner. Human beings are bonding creatures.
That's in our biological makeup, you know.
Right. We are bonding creatures, and we're social creatures. And we tend to pair bond as much as, you know, geese or ducks or whatever. I mean, they'll find out one day that it's in our DNA to pair bond, I think, except for these people who cannot do it. So I don't think that that's strange. And I think that my own search, which is reflected in Isadora's search, you know, to find somebody with whom I can share humor and who enjoys the things I enjoy. I mean, I think that's a valid search in people's lives, whether it ends in legal marriage or living together or children or no children or stepchildren. Yeah. I think it's an important thing in life.
But at the same time, we're also talking about this ghetto of Chick Lit. I mean, like, if Fear of Flying, for example, were to have been to be released right now, I would, you know, I would think that it would be sort of categorized as this chick lit
thing. Absolutely.
I mean, what do we do to combat this? I mean, is it a matter of, like, you know, getting Updike and Philip Roth on the phone and saying, "Hey, can you go ahead and help us out here and review some of these titles on their own merit, just
but
as fiction?"
Women's writing is often diminished and trivialized mm-hmm. in different ways. Chick Lit is only the most recent way of diminishing and trivializing women's writing, mm-hmm. I think. We are not seen as important. I've been called, among other things, the mother of Chick Lit, if you can imagine. Mm-hmm. But we tend to praise in women writers the exotic. We're capable of giving prizes to Arundhati Roy, and yet American women are put into the ghetto of Chick Lit. We're capable of praising Jhumpa Lahiri, who's a wonderful writer,
yes.
by the way, a wonderful writer. Also a Barnard graduate.
Yeah.
I think she's amazing. And yet,
Pulitzer,
I think, what?
I think she won the Pulitzer in 2000.
Right? Yeah, I think people are open to her because she writes about a Bengali family in America, and there's something exotic about it. We are open to Zadie Smith talking about mixed race families in Britain, but not so open to our own women. Mm-hmm. We'd rather put them in a box and say they're commercial or whatever. And that's gone on for a long time. There's always been a diminishment of women writers. Mm-hmm. It takes different forms. But in general, the period when Fear of Flying came out was a more experimental, exuberant period in writing in general. You know, John Updike had written Couples. Philip Roth had written Portnoy. People were experimenting with a new freedom to write about the bedroom without leaving a trail of asterisks. Mm-hmm. Remember that Lolita had been banned, that Lady Chatterley's Lover you could only get in the rare book room, that Tropic of Cancer you had to smuggle back from Paris. And suddenly the law changed, mostly because of Barney Rossett and Grove Press and all the, you know, his tenacious fighting to get these books into the country. And writers were exuberant. Mm-hmm. You know, they said, oh my God, we can write about things we weren't allowed to write about before. And there was this feeling of freedom in the air. And people were experimenting with stream of consciousness, kind of Virginia Woolfian novels and Joycean novels. Now, I think the combination of commercialism and reaction, because reaction has been rampant in our country, has made the novels that come out very predictable and has also ghettoized women writers more and more and more. It's very sad because every time you look, I'm actually working on an essay about this now. Every few years we get a male novelist who everybody bows down and says, this is the new Bellow, this is the new Updike. For a while it was Jonathan Franzen. For a while it was Jeff Eugenides. Then Michael Chabon. Mm-hmm. Who's the other guy that everybody said was the Jonathan Safran Foer,
yeah.
Foer, I guess you pronounce it. And there's always a male writer.
Yeah.
And people say, ah, you know, the next Bellow.
Yeah.
But they don't ever do that with women. Ever.
I don't know, though. That Alice Munro's been getting a lot of major profiles and, you know, a lot of credit. But at the same time,
Canadian. Safely Canadian, like Peggy Atwood. I mean, you can praise a Canadian and say, you know, people are not, don't have a problem with Peggy Atwood because she's not American.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, I think that's part of it. We always prefer someone beyond our own borders, it seems.
But to also, there's one other aspect to this I'll add here, and that is, for example, Mary Gateskill's Veronica, which I mm-hmm. felt was one of the best books of last year. But in order to actually, like, you know, be sort of legitimized, it's almost like Gateskill had to write about a really sort of unpleasant hepatitis, and it's a really brutal and rough but yet poetic book. And it's sort of like, in order for women to be sort of considered on the same tier as male writers, they almost have to sort of, like, you know, go for, like, the, you know, full adrenaline, you know, balls to the wall, so to speak.
And gothic.
Yeah.
And gothic. Yeah. I was thinking last night, I was watching, I was in my hotel room and I wasn't sleepy, so I turned on Brokeback Mountain, which I had never seen.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of Annie Proulx and the recognition she's gotten as an American woman writer. She writes about men.
Yeah.
Almost exclusively. And when you think of Brokeback Mountain, think of how laconic the two men are.
Yeah.
Think about, they're not into words, they're gruff. Even in the first lovemaking scene, there's a kind of violence. Her writing is very male.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the reasons people approve of it in the literary world. Think also of other writers who have been so vastly approved of, like Annie Prue,
or their
Andrea Barrett.
Yeah.
Seafaring tales.
Yeah.
Another kind of male genre. But if you write about the bedroom, the kitchen, child rearing, a wedding, it's presumed to be trivial. Now, you can write well or badly about any subject. You can write well or badly about whaling. You can write well or badly about the kitchen or the bedroom. It's all about how perceptive you are, what a good writer you are, and all of that. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me women writers are always ghettoized one way or another.
Or the other example I was going to make was like Kelly Link is very, very hot right now. And she wrote a very great series of stories called Magic for Beginners. But genre. So you can go ahead and categorize them in genre,
what
too.
What genre would she...
Like fantasy, science fiction.
Uh-huh.
But it stands up on its own terms. But I guess where I was kind of going with this was the whole idea of a woman who writes comic exuberance, such as yourself, you know, mm-hmm. is immediately sort of ghettoized in this kind of, you know, this chick lit or this sort of like, it's trivial. I mean, comedy itself already has enough of a bad rap. People think it's because people laugh that it's somehow lighter, when in fact it's a lot harder to write, you know?
Yeah.
So
that is true.
I mean, it's almost like you're kind of facing kind of a double death knell here. You
know? But I notice that in, you know, that is my reputation here in my own country. But I notice that from the mail that I get and the master's theses and PhD theses that come to me from Hungary and Poland and Japan, that's not the view of my reputation elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And that the whatever my writing has created is taken seriously in other places. Less so here. You know, you're never a prophet in your own land. Mm-hmm. Here I may be categorized as a sex writer or comic sex writer or whatever. But every day I receive, you know, somebody's master's thesis from another country,
yeah.
where they compare my various novels and poems and study the stuff thematically and say that I've invented new metaphors for women writers or new paradigms for women writers. So I guess I am appreciated, but not yet here. Mm-hmm. So
maybe you should come out as Canadian.
Right.
Something like that. Okay. I know we got to wrap this up fairly soon. But there's actually one thing I wanted to... well, first of all, I wanted to ask, do you think today's fiction is confrontational enough, particularly from women?
No. It is not confrontational enough. I think in general, journalists are not confrontational enough. I think publishing houses are scared and are looking for pigeonholes and genres and are really terrified of Barnes & Noble and Borders for fear they won't buy the books. Mm-hmm. I mean, publishers need to be braver. Instead of looking for a repeat of the genre that sold in the last decade. Look, I've been through enough decades in publishing to see that I've seen the sex and shopping novel come and go. I think we'll see chick lit come and go and be replaced by something else. I think that we have to be more adventurous. And I think we have to encourage writers to be more experimental. I think it's really important.
But as you point out in this book, with the publishers becoming leaner and meaner,
yeah.
And more commercial, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, any tinge of sort of, I mean, you know, you hear writers who go through like these rejection and one of the big sort of things that come back on the rejection letters are, this is too literary. As if literary is a bad word.
Yeah, like so, liberal. It's yeah. become the L word.
Yes.
Yeah.
Almost too the exact literary. Same, I think the same amount of letters there.
Yes, exactly.
Go figure.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, as publishing has condensed so that there are now, you know, five big conglomerates that run commercial publishing, and they're pretty much indistinguishable from each other. But then...
Oh, I think I might awful. Be your next person.
Hello? Could you send it up? Thank you. It's just a fax.
Okay.
So,
Just the facts, ma'am.
So I think there's a lot of fear of going beyond the accepted genres. But the only way we're going to find the next trend is through the writers.
Yeah.
You know, the genres that are known to us now should be transcended. Also, talking about humor and writing, the writers I've always loved are funny. I love Dickens' humor. Mm-hmm. I think that doesn't take away from his seriousness at all. I love his social satire. I love Byron and his social satire. I did my master's thesis on Alexander Pope. I love satire. I've always loved Oscar Wilde and his satirical point of view. So you can be a serious writer and be funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not all Tolstoy. Tolstoy is a monument for me because he's such an acute psychological observer. And he is not funny, at least not in translation. But many great writers are funny.
Yeah.
So I think that's a silly prejudice.
It's kind of interesting that it comes at a similar prejudice against, like, say, postmodern fiction. Like, mm-hmm. you know, now postmodern is a bad word, whereas the decade of Fear of Flying, it's like, you know, Barth, Barthelme, Pynchon, yeah. you know, Gaddis.
Isn't that funny, yeah. too? I mean, these fashions do change, and I really want to write more about politics of the literary world
yeah.
and how these fashions shift and how quickly they shift. You know, something is totally hot for a decade, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
When I was at Barnard, everybody was into new criticism. Nobody would criticize books via new criticism now.
Yeah.
Then we went through a whole period after the sort of sexual liberation of literature, coming on the heels of Barney Rossett fighting the anti-censorship battles. Then we got really into Native American writing. Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, if yeah. you remember. Man's Rise to Civilization as Shown by the Indians of North America.
Yeah.
Our hero was the Native American author. Then the hero became the African American author. When I started out, I remember Toni Morrison was not published by Random House, where she worked as an editor, because people said, African Americans don't buy books.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they've been proven wrong a million times. And Toni went to Holt, where I was, because her own publishing house wouldn't publish her. And I remember I wrote her a fan letter on The Bluest Eye. Mm-hmm. Whenever I run into her at a literary event, she throws her arms around me and says, "You wrote me my first fan letter."
Really?
But at that point, people really believed that African Americans didn't buy books.
Yeah.
How wrong they were. After that surge, we got into Latina American writers, how the Garcia girls lost their accent. We got into Isabel Allende. We got into writers of differing ethnicities, Asian American writing, etc. So we've been through these changes. And in fact, African American writing and Asian American writing in many ways influenced me to explore my own ethnicity.
Hmm.
Because when I read these, you know, books by Maxine Hung, Kingston, Amy Tan, others, I thought, okay, how did being Jewish and from a secular Jewish family influence my identity? So I was actually prompted to look at those things by writers of other ethnicities. And I think that was a good thing. What will be the next group that we embrace? We've embraced the Indian American writer. We've embraced Iraqi writers, Iranian writers. We want to know what happens on other sides of the world. Kite flyers, reading Lolita in Tehran, books like that. I mean, this is we're hungry to know how the rest of the world lives, which is probably a good thing, I think.
Yeah.
We want news from our books, news that stays news.
Okay.
So,
in your writing, And it's in Fear of Flying, it's in this book. You seem very obsessed with the way that people pronounce things and talk. And I was wondering if you could sort of elaborate on this. It was like for even down to Adrian Goodlove and the way that Germans pronounce things in Fear of Flying. And I think in this I found a few things as well. I just was wondering if you could possibly talk about this really quick.
How people pronounce... I guess I am very aware of it.
Yeah.
My mother was born in England. Always had, not an English accent, but sort of mid-Atlantic. My grandparents were from Russia. My maternal grandparents were from Russia. And my grandmother spoke with a heavy accent, which was endearing.
Yeah.
My grandfather, you know, spoke Russian like a white Russian, though he was Jewish and spoke French very well. And I was always interested in the way people pronounce things. God only knows why. I'm a word person, maybe. Accents were interesting to me. I remember once in my life, I asked an actor friend of mine for a speech coach because I heard a recording of myself reading my poems, and I wanted to get rid of every trace of New Yorkism in my accent. And you know what New Yorkism is. It's moving the jaw too much.
Really?
Huh. And so this voice coach sold me his little tape about how to rid yourself of regionalisms of speech. And for some reason, I was interested in that. I mean, that's the sort of thing an actor would do, not a writer, but it mattered to me.
There's actually a book. We have here in the city, we have like this really good bookstore called Limelight. Mm-hmm. And I've every time I go there, it's just devoted to theater and film-related stuff. But every time I go into this bookstore, there's this one book there that's like $200. And it has like, basically, it's like the lists how to do every single dialect, every single vernacular. Yeah. I mean, so, and I imagine like a lot of actors probably use or consult this book or have it in their library. So Erica Zhang, you're a closet linguist.
Yeah, I'm a closet linguist. Absolutely. I'm fascinated with that.
All right. Well, I know you have to get going, but thank you so much. It was a pleasure chatting.
That was really fun. Yes. That was really fun. Thanks.
Sure. Along with fear, there goes the fear again.